Welcome to another episode of Research Chat. We thought you'd like to get to know some of the committee members working behind the scenes to bring you the things like webinars, symposia, and other research committee offerings. Today I'm chatting with new member Allison Brown and lifer Nigel Sanders. So get yourself a drink, kick back, and enjoy. So Allison, as the one of the newbies, who are you? What do you do? Tell us about you.
Sure. So, hi, Eric and everyone. I'm Allison Brown, and at present, I'm a PhD candidate at Penn State, where I study food science and international agriculture and development. I study chocolate flavor for the most part here at Penn State and look at the impact of variety on chocolate flavor. So that's by and large what I do here. And before Penn State, I'll just start with my education, I guess. I studied my bachelor's degree at the University of Illinois, where I studied food science. And then I studied an accelerated culinary arts degree at the Culinary Institute of America at Greystone. After that, I worked in the wine industry for a bit and did some international cellar hand work in New Zealand and Australia and Germany and Oregon. And then I was like, I really want to get into chocolate. So I studied my master's degree at Wageningen University in the Netherlands, after which I spent about a year and a half at Ghent University doing more chocolate research. And now I find myself here in actually what is the second to last month of my PhD at Penn State. So that's the long and short of what I do. Lots of chocolate stuff.
And if anybody's interested, she has some phenomenal research out there that has some marketing angles to it with regard to chocolate preferences.
Yes, I do.
Nigel, you've been around as long as I have. What's your backstory, sir?
Hi there. Well, thanks for letting me talk here. My story actually reflects a very different era from today. And there's been a lot of serendipity into how I got to where I ended up. And I think looking back, I think it would be kind to say that I never really fitted into the mold that my high school aimed for. And subsequently, I failed my final maths exam that I needed for university entrance. And although I'd excelled in chemistry, which I loved a lot more than maths, I always knew that I could do things that well if I enjoyed them. You know, I actually liked the Beatles more than I liked either chemistry or maths, but that's another part. So in the end, I had to apply Plan B, but I didn't have a Plan B. So after a while, in a fit of extreme optimism, I looked around in the area that I grew up in, which was Bath in England, which wasn't very industrial, to tell you the truth. And I discovered there were three factories within sort of local commuting distance that actually had laboratory facilities. One of them was a tobacco company. One made car tires, rubber tires, and one was a chocolate factory. So in a fit of extreme optimism, I wrote to Cadbury's Chocolate asking if there were any openings in their laboratory. There wasn't any job adverts or anything. To my surprise, I got a positive response, an interview and a job. And I thought, well, this will do for a few months. I can, you know, earn a bit of money and go traveling or do something a little bit different. And after about 6 months, they said that they liked me a lot, and they had an educational program for staff, and I could actually do my qualifications on a part-time basis whilst working. So I'm in a situation here with having no requirement for school fees, having a wage, and eventually getting a degree in chemistry, which struck me as quite a good result. The factory that I joined in had about 50 lab technicians, and we were all testing all the raw materials that are coming into the factory. Now, that's a very weird situation compared to today, because all of that testing of products or ingredients actually ended up going back to the ingredient manufacturers. So we did everything from testing sort of all raw materials, finished goods, even wastewater effluent testing. it was during this time that it was kind of an interesting and exciting transformation, really from going from wet analytical chemistry to a lot of new instrumental techniques such as HPLC. I did a spell as a shift QA manager, which actually then got me out of the lab and into the factory and into the chocolate and candy processes up close. Then eventually I was offered another job in a new group researching potential long-term technologies, which then took me to the company's research center at the University of Reading campus. And after a couple of years, my long-term research project on the use of supercritical CO2 extraction came to a halt. We kind of decided that it was never going to be economically viable for a company to actually do that, our company to do that. And then I moved into the physical chemistry lab and ended up looking at everything to do with chocolate structure and behavior. And this technology was also developing in new viscometry techniques, the introduction of light scattering particle size analyses. I mean, I think the first particle size analyzer that I ever used went down to 2.9 microns. And anything below that was thought of as being irrelevant. Well, obviously, I think with the increase in knowledge, we realized that that a lot of particulates in chocolate less than 2.9 microns are very important. And on top of that, so we're actually looking at trying to quantify the science behind this, behind chocolate behavior. And on top of this, there was also the opportunity of looking at lots of novel work on the role of emulsifiers, different emulsifiers in chocolate systems. And that also led to us including an emulsifier from oats, which was patented and had some very interesting properties of being the only emulsifier that we ever found that was natural and worked in the same way as a combination of lecithin and PGPR.
That's interesting that it's coming back around now too.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you realize in this world is that, just wait, they'll come back.
Yep.
So it was all very interesting times. And I think for me, the interesting bit was that I was there sort of like really at the start of the interface of confectionery, sort of like as seen as being an art to really the first indications of the serious science of confectionery. And I really wanted to, once I'd got all this knowledge, I really wanted to try and see that it was worth applying to actually practical applications. And where I was, there was a very clear demarcation between the guys in white coats in the lab and people who worked in factories, right? There was, the interface wasn't there. And I felt that there was a really good opportunity to go and take some of that scientific knowledge and actually see how it's applied in and find some ways of applying it. So I then transferred to another part of the company, moving from Reading to Cadbury's headquarters in Birmingham. The part of the group that I was in was developing new processes and product opportunities. So this was probably back in the early 90s and working on what was going to be areas of absolute change in the industry, which, looking back on it, some of those didn't quite happen. Really the application of sugar-free confectionery and how that was going to completely change the whole of the confectionery industry, which, it hasn't really done tremendously. I mean, there have been some exceptions in areas, but in general, not really. Looking at two other technologies in temperature tolerance in chocolate and the production of reduced fat chocolates. And the Reduced fat chocolate always struck me as being interesting because the consensus of how to make reduced fat chocolate really was about making chocolate normally, but just putting less fat in. And that, to me, didn't sound the right way to go. So I spent a lot of time looking at the idea of starting with full fat chocolate and then adding the non-fat ingredients back into it. So it required a lot of pre-milling, dried mixtures of cocoa powder, sugar, and milk powder, and adding those back into the finished chocolate. And the advantage of that was that the finished chocolate basically had all its particulates all coated in emulsifier and was actually a much better place to be than trying to coat everything with emulsifiers with not really having enough fat phase there. And it led to a few patents here and there. And, at the end of the day, we haven't seen a big surge in the even the concept of reduced fat chocolate. And I think one of the reasons for that was that in order to make a claim for reduced fat chocolate in Europe, you actually had to have a 25% reduction in the fat content, which took your chocolate from, let's say, nominally 30% fat down to 22.5% fat, which then made it very difficult to handle. I mean,
good luck with those baking chips.
Yeah, so there was some possibilities of access into sort of like baking chips and that sort of thing. But as far as trying to make a product where at the end of the day, making any improvements in a new product, you've kind of got to be in a situation where that product at the end of the day has got to be not only equal to what you're trying to emulate, but actually probably has to be better in some terms. And I think the reduced fat chocolate always fell apart on mouthfeel and the other things, even if taking into account that you could find processes in which to actually produce the stuff in the first place. Yeah, the interesting thing about that, though, was that that led me into doing a lot of work looking at technologies in other industries and looking for either ways that other industries did things or looking at the ways that other industries use the same sort of equipment as we were used to in chocolate making. And one of the things that I did was I did a trawl round of some industries, and providing that you could show that you weren't competitive with people, that you could go and have a look at all sorts of things. And I remember going to a pottery company making industrial plates, and they had these massive great machines that looked unbelievably like chocolate conches. In fact, they were the same machines that we used in chocolate rotary chocolate conches, except they called them blodgers, industry being what it is. And it was interesting to see how they were using that to do the dispersion of the particulates in clay in water-based systems, and very, with some similarities to the structure of chocolate, but, that was an interesting learning. And the other thing I think was that really I remember from that time, which came as a huge revelation, was going to a factory that made pencils, crayons, and they also did a bit of making sort of paint. And they were using three-roll refiners as the ultimate mixing machines. And I think that, interestingly, I think we grew up in the chocolate industry of thinking that all that roll refiners were doing was just reducing the particle size. And yet they were using these machines to making the most pure dispersions of dye in both crayon mix and in paint. And I think that once again showing that by doing a little bit of delving into these technologies, you know, could improve the understanding of what these processes were doing for us. Very quickly, I'm coming almost to the end of my wonderful experience. One of the things I did do in terms of looking at technologies, even for the temperature tolerant chocolate, one of the issues is that you're trying to get some, normally you're trying to get some sort of water or water-based material into your chocolate so that you can end up getting some sort of network of joined up, sort of like an ecoskeleton of the sugar material.
A little bit of structure, yeah.
Structure. And then I found that one of the issues about doing that with final chocolate, though, was the fact that anything that you would normally use to try and put the water into the chocolate would actually end up detempering the chocolate if you were using tempered chocolate. And the ideal situation for making temperature tolerant chocolate is try and get the water in as far down the process as possible, you know, like even at the point of use.
And don't stop moving it.
Yeah, so I found a really interesting type of mixer that had been developed in the rubber and plastics industry in the UK. It's called a cavity transfer mixer. And it's a very low shear, very intense mixer. And those were exactly the conditions that we needed. So we got a machine made, and it worked unbelievably well at being able to add your aqueous material into the tempered chocolate.
Yep.
And so once again, this appliance of technology. One of the things then that I got involved with was a whole project on use of cook extruders in confectionery. And that ended up working doing some projects at the University of Lincoln, Nebraska. And that got me into contact with Cadbury's chocolate in Canada, and which eventually led to me being offered a short-term contract to come to Toronto to work for them. And, you know, like how serendipitous the rest of my life has been so far. My short-term contract turned into a long-term contract, and I've been here ever since. And for me, it was a very good opportunity to have a look at, once again, a bit more application of the science that I brought with me into new processes and products. And at this point, I ended up discovering the PMCA, which we'll talk about later. And I think that over the years, I would say that if I had a plan, it would have been that allegedly attributed to Yogi Berra, who said, if there's a fork in the road, take it. And I felt that feeling that I had that I didn't really fit into school also carried on to the feeling that I didn't really fit into sort of like most workplaces either. And the idea about having some creativity and being able to apply that sort of individualistically is something that I felt was a little repressed in certain places that I worked. And finding that, you know, at the end of the day, that you've got an attribute that is really valuable, really good, and you can appreciate that, I think really helps. It's helped me realize that, I have got something to offer.
Yep, it's marketable skill to somebody. I mean, if you're anything like me, you seem like you're so far outside the box, you're pulling the lid shut on one outside on yourself. That's where I find myself a lot of times, asking too many questions. But
yeah, and I think, you know, I have been in parts of the organization really where, you know, they've had courses on being creative. And you know, they've had awards for creativity where somebody's won an award for changing the flavor in a chewing gum. Yeah, I mean, to me, that doesn't sound very creative. I mean, it's obviously, you know, there's a potential commercial advantage to it, but, yeah. You know, it's that's a little bit limited. So eventually, I ending up working for myself, and I've had a consultancy in Toronto for 12 years now. I use the word semi-retired, but semi means 50%, and I'm kind of 95% retired, and there isn't a suitable word for that. So,
Alex, are you still with us?
Yeah.
I'm still here. I just muted.
So there you go. A little bit of a long, long potted history, but I think it's, you know, there have been some very interesting and relevant parts of this. You know.
I think both of you point to the interesting dichotomy of the makeup of the committee from age to experience to knowledge base. It's just amazing. Allison is one of the newest members. What drew you to PMCA in particular research?
I was fortunate to attend the PMCA annual conference the first year of my PhD here at Penn State. I couldn't believe that a conference like that existed, and I had never been there before. It's the coolest conference of all time, and you get
you'd be surprised how often we actually hear that.
I'm sure, and I'm like, man, if only. It's the most fun conference that's ever existed because it's not just presentations, but there's also, you know, the nice applied element too, where it's like a workshop and there's moving around and there's, you know, different things going on. And it's such an engaging way to learn about confections and then to learn about the breadth of confections that exist and the methods that are used to make confections and kind of understand the science behind the lore that I think happens in a lot of confections. So I was blown away and I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever. I want to come every year that I can as part of the student outreach program, which I maxed out my student outreach program attendance because I think it's 3 years or?
Wasn't Ed Wilson one of your mentors?
Ed Wilson was one of my mentors, yes. And that was great because then I started thinking like, oh, well, what is leadership? Like, you know, you go and you're like, well, this is a cool conference and I'm a student and I feel overwhelmed by everything going on. And then you kind of like, you have these mentors and then you kind of slowly but surely parse out that like the conference is one event that's put on by this organization that exists all the time. And that this organization has several committees that do really cool things year round. So then I slowly but surely like, you know, parsed out what PMCA actually was all about and discovered that there was this research committee. And as someone, you know, who's dedicated a lot of my adult life to education and research, I was like, yeah, I want to be part of the committee of this great organization where I can kind of maybe have input or maybe even learn about what's going on in terms of the research that they fund and steer. And I think too, like as someone who's deep in a PhD and in academia, especially at Penn State, where we do a lot of chocolate work. We also do other confections too, actually, but we're pretty deep in the chocolate stuff. It's been really interesting to see, you know, what's hot in academia in terms of confections and then compare that to the PMCA Research Committee, which is, you know, composed of academics, but then also a lot of industry folks too. So it's a really interesting cross section of, okay, what's happening in confections and in confectionery research questions right now. So I guess that's what drew me to PMCA, this epic conference. And then the idea of being part of a research committee that would steer current and future research in a field that I really love.
Nigel, I'm going to ask you the same question, but perhaps from the long view. What drew you to PMCA? I mean, a lot of us kind of was suggested by a supervisor that maybe you want to check this out, but how did you get involved?
Well, I have to say that I don't think I had even heard of the PMCA until I came to Canada. I'm pretty sure that there wasn't an organization, anything like it in the UK that I was aware of, at least. I came to my first conference and I think it might have been around 1999, 2000, something in that sort of region. I'm a bit hairy on dates these days. But I was amazed to see how much of a community there was, and about how it was very different from the commercial environment that I was in and had been, about trying to absolutely maintain secrecy, competitive advantage, and everything else. And I saw that as being something absolutely wonderfully unique, even in terms of some of the projects that I've seen. You know, that the PMCA has been involved in some of the areas which I did work in the early 90s, and obviously sort of like with some commercial protection on them. But looking at those in a much more general way, and and the fact that you could set up a project on something or other, and that project would then be in the public domain, and I think that it was that really attracted me to the PMCA, and I think the research committee has certainly changed in the time that I've been on it, and it's been an interesting and very gradual change. I don't think there's been a lot of massive step changes. I think it's been sort of fairly gradual. I think I don't know of any other organization apart from maybe the AACT, which once again, I'm not particularly heavily involved with as much as the PMCA, but seeing that there is an opportunity to definitely help the smaller companies who don't have the research resources that the large companies do, and seeing how free the information was at the PMCA was an absolute game changer for me.
It's interesting you say how we've changed, but I would say evolved. It's not necessarily better or worse, but we've evolved and we've tried to adapt ourselves to new ways of thinking or working, or even how like money's distributed or how research is funded, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, some of the changes on just the questions of, what projects should we be promoting?
Yep.
Who has the say on that, whether it be the PMCA or the academics? There's definitely been a change in that. And I think for the better. I think having a bit more control over what we think the membership want a bit more, although that's always been a tricky one. People don't know what they don't know. So, that's been a bit of a tricky conundrum, but.
And trying to get it out of them is always a difficult task as well.
Yeah. I think for me as well, with some of the other things that have been interesting, has been the development of first of all, the webinars, and I think one of the things that we used to sort of laugh about in the committees quite a lot was that shall we do a science symposium? Shall we do something or other? And so let's leave it to next year. Let's procrastinate on that one.
Well, sometimes it seems like self-indulgent fluff, but that's never our intent. But it's almost like, all right, how do we put fannies in seats? What's going to draw? I don't want to put Alice on the spot here, but maybe she has some interesting insights into how the funding goes, or if she has any thoughts at all on how we might compare to, say, another organization or entity.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't sat on a lot of funding committees per se. I think that would probably be a good question for a professor to kind of compare and contrast.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm someone who's received funding from the USDA and other organizations. And I guess for me, it's just been fascinating to see what happens on the back end, because when you spend hours and days and months working on a research proposal and you think certain things are important, and then you're on the other side and you're like, oh, well, maybe certain things aren't as important as I thought they were. And maybe it really kind of comes down to that committee's goals and their objectives, and not, you know, that my idea was wrong, or my idea was like, wasn't a good idea, or something like that I may have proposed at some point, but that it really is about alignment almost with, like, is what you are proposing aligned with what that committee wants to happen?
Well, you know, sometimes it's not that simple. Sometimes,
right.
You know, we get such, when we put out a request for proposal, we get such diverse topics that we agonize for weeks or months, even trying to figure out what to focus on, because they're so different, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Totally. And I think, like, I don't know, it's interesting seeing that. I think it's a critical part of understanding how research works, right? Like, in general, research is funded by other bodies that you need to propose research to, and that it's not, was the idea good or bad, but, you know, is it what's in line with they want to be with what that organization wants to be doing right now, you know?
I was just going to say, I think that one of the other things that has been quite difficult is trying to filter out some of the proposals into, you know, what is going to be of real benefit in some sort of application to the membership.
Absolutely.
And there's always been sort of like, you know, very esoteric ideas about using sort of like very fancy technology for doing something. And then you realize that, you know, if that technology is coming in at $100,000 as a start off, then, you know, you've just wiped that possibility of being applicable to a large proportion of the membership. So, you know, where does that line come in?
When I was putting these questions together, one note I put to myself in here is research committee consistently tries to ride the line between relevant confectionery science and applicable developments while trying to make those developments relatable to the membership. That's where we sit every time we try and figure how to handle these proposals.
And it's a very difficult balance to try and make as well, which is, and I think one of the things that has been good and has been very positive about the research committee is over the last later years has been the change in attitude of we have to spend some money, let's just do whatever comes up, or should we just postpone this year's projects until something sort of appropriate turns up? And I think that's been a very positive difference in view, I think, in terms of how the research committee is going to make it more relevant to the membership.
Well, that and the fact that the organization lost its major funding for at least 2 years now, but that's neither here nor there. To that particular point, do either of you have any particular confectionery interests you'd like to see researched? You know, maybe we throw them out here.
I can go. I think from where I sit, and I think from the findings that I'm writing up with my dissertation right now, and this is a very like biased and very focused viewpoint, I think that this craft chocolate movement, the interest that craft chocolate has in finer flavor cacao, I think is a big deal. And I think is what I'm seeing as I, you know, try to put together a literature review is that there's just not a lot out there, and that I would suggest that there's some things to discover about finer flavor cacao and what those flavors actually are. I think the other thing that I would be interested in researching more is just kind of modern day chocolate making, because I think, and Nigel kind of spoke to interesting kind of cycle we're in with regards to chocolate technology and chocolate cycles of popular things that come in and out of vogue. The other thing would be just really understanding and putting in the public domain, like, the impact of what a roller refiner actually does and what a conch actually does. And if there's a way to, you know, understand beyond what we know right now and really just kind of streamline that process. Because I think what I'm kind of realizing with my work is that there's a little bit of lore in the industry. You know, there's some cool things that have been happening for over 100 years. And when you start to question, like, well, why is that happening? Why do we use that machine? Why do we do that? And then you look to science or published articles to see, like, okay, well, what does a conch really do? It's not there. And so while there might be, you know, inside company knowledge of this, I don't think it's in the public domain. And then I guess the trickle down effect of that is that as we have this craft chocolate movement going forward, the lore kind of continues. And so rather than being able to say, well, this is what the science says about what a conch does, it's just like, kind of dispersing more lore.
It's like where art and science collide and there's no, yeah. there's no firm information on it. Yeah. It's a good point.
Yeah. So, and I mean, Eric, like I'm sure at Barry Callebaut, like I'm sure Barry Callebaut has, you know, reasons and ways of doing things. But then when you try to translate that to other people, it gets really tricky because there's just not a lot out there. And,
I mean, everyone's trying to find a way to optimize their process. And again, like I said, art and science collide. I mean, you know, art tells you, you know, X temperature for Y time to develop a particular flavor note. Well, what can we do to accelerate that and drive power costs out or something like that? And they're going to be reluctant to share that information, but there's got to be a way to boil it down for basic, like even for the bean to bar people, like FCIA would probably be really interested in, you know, at least suggestions as to how to optimize processes.
I think one of the things that I think would be very useful to do, and it's been mentioned by both you and Eric, is the concept of trying to look to really understanding the differences between chocolate making on scales, right? And, you know, we all realize that, you know, that the large companies are very typically, you know, making tons an hour and these small companies are making kilos a day, you know. And trying to look to seeing sort of what the differences are, you know, what are the differences? You know, we always have the myth that, you know, things like conching actually, you know, you really benefit from doing it on a large scale, you know, compared to a small one, you know, for some aspects of it. You know, is there something that we can start thinking about in terms of trying to do like CSI chocolate, you know, the looking at like the influence of scale on the technologies of scale on the actual process itself and on the final product?
Well, you know, Nigel, you and I have both been there where we've had people try and quantify a lab size batch to get the same flavor development or whatever in the actual industrial conch. And there are people who swear up and down that, yeah, if you do this, you do that, it'll be it's never the same.
Yeah, it isn't. And I think to actually quantify, you know, have some real quantification of why that is the case, you know, might be, you know, might open up a whole can of worms, but it might be something that could keep the research committee going for years, you know?
One of my first supervisors when I started here at BC, he used to tell me, when I worked in a previous life, I had people would come to me and say, if I move this conch 1 inch to the left, chocolate's going to taste different. And you know, there's people out there that would agree.
My brain's just trying to process that. I'm sorry.
Maybe there was a leak in the ceiling and
struck me dumb. Yeah.
So Nigel, anything you particularly see as a research interest?
No, I think that you know the question is you know is what is the membership doing? I think we have ventured a little bit into I think the symposium on the use of cannabis in confectionery making. was unbelievably interesting, and it really is a new market, and something I think that we contributed with that symposium to appeal to the people in the business.
And you know what? That's a testament to how the membership's evolved over the years as well, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And I think keeping an eye on sort of opportunities like that, I'm not sure that that there's much else apart from quantification of scale in chocolate making processes particularly.
I want to kind of wrap this up, but I'll start with Allison. As a member, what do you see as the benefits to anyone out there listening to this as PMCA in general, or being a member of any of the committees, whether it's personally or in the big picture?
For me, it's really fascinating to have this cross-section across, you know, companies, universities, et cetera, cross-section of what people think is important to research right now. Like, I don't know where else you would even be able to access that, you know? Like, here we are in our Penn State bubble going down our road, but then if you take a step back and you join the research committee, you get to see like, oh, well, this is, you know, what this university thinks is important. This is what this company, you know, representative, I guess, thinks is important. And that has been really interesting to me to kind of get like a more broad view of research topics. I think the other thing that's been really cool for me personally is to kind of meet people who I've seen talk on the PMCA stage or, you know, during the pandemic, I've heard them in the PMCA research chat. And now I get to talk to them in a committee meeting. So, you know, if you kind of like geek out listening to certain people at the at the conference or in the research chat, it's like, oh my gosh, now I'm like actually like having a conversation with them.
There's
like
somebody that thinks the same thing I do.
Yeah, like this is really cool. And how else would this have happened, right? Like, I mean, to use the word that everybody loves to hate, it's expanded my network and really like given me an opportunity to have a meaningful connection with people, you know, outside of just geeking out about them. So to be in a work environment and be making really, you know, complex decisions about how the committee is moving forward shoulder to shoulder with those people virtually at this point, you know, has been really cool. The other thing, and Nigel spoke to this a little bit earlier, but I guess more broadly, like to the membership, I mean, I feel put in a pretty privileged spot to really be part of the cog in the wheel that helps to determine rather, where membership funds and where PMCA funds might go to promote research that is then ultimately available in the public domain and to the PMCA. So kind of being a part of that process to determine what research should go on for the greater good of the organization. So those are kind of the two big things that I see as benefits.
Dr. Sanders, same question, sir.
I think the same sort of thing. I think the opportunity having contacts with people. I mean, the research committee has been has had a pretty wide variety of expertise and interests on there. Lots of suppliers, manufacturers, academics, and it's been a good resource to. You know, in my consultancy work, on occasions something comes up and I go, oh, I don't know this, but oh, I know somebody to ask. And that's one of the secrets of being a consultant, if I'm allowed to get that way.
You know what? That's the joy of knowing suppliers too, to the networking point. Because I remember, all right, I'm going to call him out on this, when I made a big switch from a previous life to where I am now, Ed Wilson pulled me aside and he said, you always have people like me you can call. And I wouldn't have met people like that if I hadn't have been involved in PMCA or AACT.
I concur completely on that. I think it's been a very, very valuable resource for me. And it's, you know, and the fact that it's changing and, you know, we're having a pretty good rotation of people coming through the committee. And it's always good to, you know, have people like Allison who are bringing a new view to how things are, because I mentioned earlier on that I come from sort of like the dinosaur age, and to hear sort of like have a bit more concurrent. I don't think we want to go on TikTok with this. That's the next thing, but
contain ourselves.
But I think we've got something good here, and I think that I'm certainly very appreciative to be part of it, and it's been a very rewarding experience for me so far.
I think the whole networking aspect sometimes gets a negative connotation from a higher level. People need to recognize that is exactly what drives what we do and makes it so different.
One of the things that I've kind of fought over in my whole life in these industries is people who do not respect their competitors. I mean, it got to one point where one certain group that I worked with weren't even allowed to say the name of their competitor. I mean, how stupid is that? I mean, honestly, that's one of the things that the PMCA has done is shown that that the people who might be commercially competitive with are still very valuable to listen to, and you need to learn from that. You can't shut yourself in a bubble and pretend that these things aren't happening. And we need to be a bit more realistic. And I think the PMCA is a good focus point for doing that.
Well, I'm going to take this opportunity to say thanks for having this fantastic discussion, you guys. I'm so happy that you guys are on the committee. Thanks for joining us. I hope people enjoyed it. Look forward to doing more of these kind of things.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
This has been another episode of PMCA Research Chat. Please subscribe and like us on your podcast service. Check us out at pmca.com, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.